Okay, so we should go ahead and get started. Just a heads up. You have your first exam in a couple of weeks. I will feed you more information about the details on that soon. So we'll establish exactly what's on it, where the material stops, and the details. Since some of you may have questions about this, I'm not real big on memorizing equations and stuff like that. So you can take one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper and write anything you want on that. And then I'll give you a formula sheet. Well, I'll go give you a formula sheet anyway. And it is likely if you have a nasty integral, I would have an integral table with some number of integrals on there. If integrals on the table doesn't necessarily mean you will find it on the exam. Just hopefully, if you need something on the exam and you have a clue about what you're doing, it, you hopefully will find the integral on the sheet. There are past exams available at a link on the class website, which you can use to get a sense of exams or life. Any other questions you have on that? You can look back at the previous exams and have a really good sense of what will be on the equation sheet, because I'm going to start from that, and I won't even change it unless I have to. I will try to post exactly what will be on the exam if I can get it done ahead of time. I have learned that it's a good idea for me to actually finish the exam, do the exam myself, and then look carefully at the formula sheet before I release it. Disasters happen. If I do it, I make a mistake when I'm doing the solution. And then you guys catch my mistake during the exam. That's not good.
But that doesn't happen too often, so I'm trying to avoid that.
Anything else? Yes?
Are we going to get our homework back?
Thank you for asking. I have piles of homework sitting in my office, and I looked at them 3 minutes before walking to class and realized there were a reasonable number of zeros in the first 10 of them that I looked at, and I thought, So I thought I should connect and look and make sure I very much understand the criteria that the grader was using and that we agree on it before I actually hand them back to you, so I know what to say or we get to discuss it and change something. So I don't know yet what's going on with that. But I will try to get those back to you Thursday. When I did look at them, there was one with no name. So when you find that you go looking for yours, if you find that it has no name on the hand and back, you need to make sure that I know who you are and that you did it, so that you get it in the spreadsheet. One person is not yet in Blackboard and is starting to get late for that, so you need to fix that and get registered in the class. Otherwise, I don't even have your name in Blackboard to put you great. So, okay, any other issues? Alright, how did the Thursday lecture go for you guys? Technically okay? Alright, yeah, I got no questions. Any questions on that side? Okay. So what I did though is we sort of finished up on Gauss's law. I'm not planning to do anything directly with Gauss's law, you know, now. So I've done what I'm gonna do, and I was just it's going to happen again and again because I forgot how it works.
It still should come back. It looks fine up here, so
Let's try this. That big projector has just got the issues. So, anyway, okay, so any questions on Gauss's law, conceptually or practically at this point? Okay, so get real good at it. And then we started a discussion of energy and potential last time, and so I wanted to continue that today. So here's the man of the hour. We talked about energy, and if we discuss how much work it takes to move charge from one point to another, the amount of work per unit charge is what we call the volt. So it's in joules per coulomb, and it's named after this guy, Count Alessandro Giuseppe Antonio Anastasio Volta. And he's apparently a very angry guy. Anyway, so he actually invented the voltage pile, which is the forerunner of the modern battery. And I hope you will soon realize how useful the concepts are that we'll be using. So last time we defined the volt as the work per unit charge that it takes to move the charge from one point to another. We don't, in doing that, specify the path necessarily. You can specify the path, but it's really the difference. It's important. So this is related to the energy because it's the work per unit charge, and work and energy are different phases of the same thing. And we call this difference in the potential, this potential difference, that is, how much work it takes to move from here to here. That actually is very well defined in any given problem. Okay? What is less well defined is whether you think of it as having an absolute potential or an absolute energy. So this is very similar to the same issue that you have if you talk about what is height for a building. You could talk about differences in height and have that be very well defined. But if you want to talk about absolute height or absolute, you have to have a zero. So just like potential energy and gravity, these problems where somebody is sliding down a sliding board, if you want to talk about change in energy, it's easy, but if you want to talk about absolute energy or something, you need to define a zero to be able to think about the problem. So the same is true in electricity. So absolute potential requires that you figure out what you mean. So you either have to have a zero defined, or it doesn't have to be a zero. I could define, you know, something to have a specific value, and then you can take everything with respect to that. But you have to have something well defined in order to start talking about absolute potential. You will find that the terminology, usually there's a V involved for volts or potential differences, but outside of that, the terminology is a little bit all over the place. Sometimes it's very specific, so the voltage between points 1 and 2, or the potential at point 2 minus the potential at point 1, which sort of implies that you have an absolute potential at 2 and at 1, and you're just, but really it's this, you might see it like that, you might see delta V, or you might just see V. So you have to infer what is meant by context a little bit. Okay, so very specifically last time, we did a calculation where there was some positive charge, point charge, sitting in space. And I took a little positive test charge, Q0, and I moved it along a radial line from point A to point B. And we calculated how much work it took to do that. And what we found when we did this integral, right, so we integrated the force times ds, where ds is the little arc length, little bits of arc length as you go, not arc length, but path length as you go from A to B. And because it had radial symmetry, we knew what E was, so The electric field times the charge gives you the force. You know the little ds's. You can do the dot product. So you can do that calculation. And when we did, we found that the work is equal to k times little q0 times big Q over 1 over rb minus 1 over ra. So rb is smaller than ra. So this number is bigger than that one, which means this quantity is positive, which is a good thing because the test charge is positive. And I'm asking in this particular problem what work it takes for me to move that charge in. And so it better be positive because I have to push the little q0 in to get it closer to the big Q. Okay? So you're used to doing these kinds of things in mechanics, where you take positive work to lift a book up against the force of gravity, negative work if you put it down, which may seem weird because biologically you're still doing work, it seems, and it seems positive to you, but the force you are exerting to keep the thing from just crashing to the ground is up while you're moving it down, so the dot product is negative. So that's where you get in the negative work. So you have the same sort of thing here, but now it can really get you twisted in knots because in addition to all of that, you have the ability for the sign of the charge to be different. And so what I find is that I was very careful when I set this up because I find probably 50% of the time when I do these types of problems, I'll get to the end of it and I'll have the wrong sign for the work. And then I have to go back and figure out where I dropped the sign. So it's in the dot product or the increment of how ds and dr are or the sign of the charge or whatever. So you will find the bookkeeping can be more painful than you may be used to in mechanics. So just get used to that. But let me ask you, so if this is the amount of work it takes, then we can define the potential difference between points A and B as this quantity of work divided by the charge that's being moved, this little q0. So the voltage, the potential difference here is this quantity. And then my question to you is, suppose I took that little charge and instead of just being nice and behaved and go straight in radially, suppose I did this. What would that be, my answer? What do you think? Correct.
Nothing.
Nothing. Why? Why is it doing nothing?
Because whenever you would move it like in one direction and then have to move it the other way, it's like sort of come back as close to be, you'd have the negative work and the positive work, and so then that sum would become the same as before.
Okay. So remember what work is. Work is F dot ds. It's the integral of F dot ds. So ds I might be changing because I go all over the place. So its direction may be changing. But the direction of the force depends on the electric field. And if the electric field is always radial, then F dot ds is basically going to be E dot the path. And E is radial. So what happens is, regardless of how weird I do this, it's only that radial component that gets projected out and put into that dot product. So it is path independent. So that path independence actually is something that we're going to find that's incredibly useful. You now probably have done enough with the electric field and calculating things, doing electric field integrals, to respect the fact that if I'm trying to do this calculation and keep track of the direction in the process of having to do this calculation, it becomes really hard, right? Because I integrate over this charge thing, but now the direction of the electric field as I'm doing my integral and summing things up to see what it is at this point, it's different for every point I choose over here. And that's enormously painful. Okay? So direction is an added complication. Energy is nice because energy doesn't have a direction. And that's what we're sort of seeing here. There's an energy difference between A and B, but there's no direction involved, so it doesn't matter how I got from A to B. There's a fixed amount of energy that has to be put into it for that to happen. So, we have a way of saying that in physics. So electrostatics, or more generally electromagnetism, when we get it all together. Is a conservative force. So there's no political judgment here. Conservative in the sense that if I put in work and move something, I'm not losing energy to some ill-defined path-dependent thing. So, like friction, for example. If we were sliding that charge in a viscous fluid, then there would be path dependence, because it would care how far I go in the fluid if I ask how much work it takes for me to move from here to here. So just like when I add friction into a sliding board problem, it becomes more complicated and you have to worry about it. And maybe you're given enough information to actually calculate a friction, but often you may not be. So the path matters then. So if something is a change in energy is path independent, then you say that it's a conservative system. So you can think of perfect springs, gravity. Those are examples of conservative systems that you've already studied. So that path independence is really very important for us. So if you're sort of an engineering type, you may argue, but that's sort of an approximation, right? You can't truly eliminate friction on a sliding board, even in a frozen pond, right? It's an approximation. And that's true. If you're wanting to do a problem to very high precision in the real world, you might need to worry about that. In physics, we play games where we make approximations and try to study the essence of things. And I hope that you've seen in mechanics how useful it was to have these conservative systems with springs and gravity and such, because you could learn a whole lot about the system as a whole and do pretty good calculations about things with these assumptions. So it's going to be the same in electricity. All right, so let's suppose we have this system. Which we've already seen. And let's assume for the moment, let's just let A go to infinity. So if I let A go to infinity, then this term becomes zero. And under these circumstances, the work it takes for to place the charge Q0 at point B is equal to K little Q0 cubed over R sub B. Or I could say that if you want to think about it, a charge out at infinity has relatively little, vanishingly small interaction with the big Q that we have in front of us. Okay, so it is common practice, i.e. 99% of the time, it is sensible to define the zero for energy to be out at infinity. And if you've defined it that way, then you now have something which is absolute potential. If I now bring little Q in from infinity, that is where the energy is zero, I can ask, how much energy does it take to assemble this system? And that is going to go as K times QQ over R. Or if I want to do that, then I can define the absolute potential of charge Q at point B to be KQ over RB. Okay, so it's a very simple thing. You good with that? I hope that makes intuitive sense for you. As you're doing problems, I think you will actually find that you'll get really used to doing this for point charges and thinking about it that way. Bear in mind, we made a choice that fit what we're talking about here. It is probably the most common thing, and you will get used to it. You will almost certainly run into a problem here and there where the choice of putting the zero at infinity makes no sense. You'll be given something else that'll define the absolute potential. There'll be some plate over here with a fixed potential. And if you're given that, then that sets everything, okay? You're not necessarily saying it's zero at infinity because you've said it's somewhere else. So, use it. Use it well. But just remember, we just chose a zero, so you need to think that through every problem. Bear that in mind. Okay. So let's look at electric potential. A way to think about the potential of a system is it's associated with energy. It's effectively how much energy does it take to bring all those charges in from infinity and construct the system. So it is a measure of the amount of energy that's in the system that's associated with the electric charge, right, with the electric force. All right, so we let V equals zero at infinity. Then we look at the potential of a point charge. Point P defined by the vector R. Then the potential at point P due to charge Q is equal to KQ over R magnitude. No direction. And remember, if I were to ask, for example, what is the field at point P, it would have to have a direction. If I ask, what is the force at point P, it would have a direction. Two long points, right? So this is a distinctly different beast.
Let's suppose I have point P over here, and I have a system of discrete charges. So point P is there, and then I have, you know, a Q1 here, a Q2 over here, a Qn over here, etc. Then Q1 might be defined relative to point P. So relative to Q1, point P is given by vector R1, and there is a direction there. Relative to point Q2, point P is given by vector R2, and relative to Qn, we have point P given by the vector R.
And if I were to ask you to calculate the Coulomb force, you would have to worry about the distance as well as how these directions add up, because you have to add it vectorially. Okay? But notice how simple a potential calculation is. The potential at point P is just simply the sum of the potentials. So it's the sum over I equal 1 to n of k q sub I over r sub I. And you don't have to worry about direction at all. The charge matters, and you can't have negative contributions to this, right? If I have different algebraic sign q's in here, then it's going to contribute. And that actually should make sense to you. Let's suppose I have a little ball of positive charge here. Okay? And I ask, how much work does it take for me to move a positive charge in from infinity? I'm having to do positive work on the system. So if I bring in that positive charge, I'm going to increase the potential of this system overall, the amount of energy that's in it. If I have a negative charge and I bring it in, now I'm doing negative work to the system. And a way to think about it is that charge is sort of being sucked into this thing. And when it's in here, it's going to sort of reduce the overall energy that's stored in the system overall. So you do have the algebraic sign of work is important. So, again, you guys are in a class that's basically for training physicists. So when you say this, you don't say it's just an algebraic sum. Usually you would say it as it's a scalar sum. So a scalar is something that has no directions, has only a magnitude. So we talk about temperature as a scalar. Okay, we can go one deeper. You can imagine that there's a mapping of the temperature of this room, a three-dimensional mapping. Every point in this room has a temperature, right? So we call that collective thing the temperature field. All right? If we were doing the same thing, but instead of temperature, we were recording the wind speed and direction at every point in the room, then I would have a wind velocity field. All right? So you can have fields of any sort of mathematical beast you want. It's just sort of this one-to-one map. So, anyway, potential is a scalar field, if you want. So, anyway, that's a scalar sum of potentials. I bet you know what's coming next. So I have some potato of charge. Okay. And I have a point P out here. And what I would like to know is, what is the potential at point P?
So what I mean, if I define the zero of energy potential to be out at infinity, what I mean by that is, here exists a potato of charge. How much energy does it take for me to bring a little positive charge in from infinity and plop it down at point P? That's what you're after. That's what you mean when you say, what is the potential at point P in this problem?
And you can imagine that this could be strange and different if I did something to the problem to tell you that the zero isn't out of infinity. Then you have to rethink things. Okay. But right now it's going to be out of infinity. And to think about this, the way to think about it is, let us imagine, because I don't know how to deal with a big pile of charge. That's complicated. But what I do know is, if I have just a tiny little dq here, I know what to do with that. Because regardless of how complicated that charge distribution is, I can think of that little dq as a little constant point charge right at that point. And I want to consider that point charge and what it does at point P. So I'll say that it's at a vector r relative to point P. And I can ask, what is the potential, I'll call it a little differential potential because it's due to a differential charge. And I treat it just like we've done for a point charge. So I say that the potential at point P is equal to K dQ over R. And now to get the total potential at point P, all I have to do is to sum up that over all the little dqs, which is an integral. So I integrate over the charge distribution. K dq over R. And typically, although not always, this dq you will think of as a rho dv, and you'll handle it just like you've been doing Coulomb and electric field calculations. Except, you don't have to worry about the direction. And I hope you're enormously annoyed at the directions and doing all these cos and thetas and crap and trying to figure out how to put it into the right coordinate system. If you're not enormously annoyed by that at this stage, you probably aren't as engaged in this class as you ought to be, I think. Because those are annoying problems. So this gets rid of the direction. And that will make many types of geometries way easier to calculate if you're after the potential instead of the field. Okay? So that is a positive thing. It's not always that way. So one of the things that you need to do in thinking about the upcoming exam or in thinking about the physics of the whole is you need to try to be a little systematic in recognizing geometries where it is reasonable to calculate the electric field if you're a mere mortal. Okay? And there will be other geometries that are reasonable to calculate with potential, but unreasonable with the electric field. And occasionally even the other way around. So you want to be a little systematic in looking at these geometries, because you won't always be told, which you may use the potential to get something else, like an electric field, and there'll be other ways to do it. And so you'll just be told to get the electric field. You could calculate it directly, or you could go through the potential, and you have to decide which way to go. And very often, there'll be one way which is much better than the other way. So you want to get good at that. Any questions? Okay. So I just alluded to it, but I might ask you, you know, why do you care? Could be you don't. Fine. Here's why I think you ought to care.
If you want to think about it this way, if it takes work for me to move a chart from this point to this point, that is, there is a potential difference. That's a measure of the force times distance that I have to do here. Okay? If I have a very strong electric field here, for the same distance, it's going to take more force. Okay? So there's a relation between the electric field and sort of this difference in work in any given system. So here's why you care about often why you care about calculating potential. The electric field component in some generic direction, which I'll call S, is equal to minus the derivative of the potential in that direction. Again, maybe you shouldn't be surprised if I take this ds and I put it over here, I effectively have a measure of work because electric field is close to force times ds. If I sort of integrate over both sides, this becomes the work per unit charge, and this is basically the work integral that you're doing. So there's this deep relation. What is the dot product when you're calculating from this point to that point gives you this strange thing where you're saying the electric field along a certain direction is given by the derivative in that direction. All right? So this turns out to be really important. And one of the reasons it's really important is that it allows you, if I were to give you the potential as a function of space, you can take the derivative of it and get the electric field in a certain direction. So that means if you have a geometry where it is not possible for a mere mortal to calculate the Coulomb force or the electric field because the direction is really horrible, maybe it's possible to look at it and calculate the potential because you don't have the direction, get that simple function, and take the derivative of it. And out pops the electric field. So there's this deep relationship, and it's often very useful to do this. Now, you'll note that it's not as simple as just taking a derivative because I have to project out a particular direction here. So I'm quite specific. The electric field along a certain coordinate that you've chosen is negative the derivative of the potential function, whatever it is, in that direction with respect to that variable only. Okay, so it's very similar to if I'm at the top of a hill, it might make sense if I want to say what would be the gradient of the hill or the steepness of the hill in specific directions. I have to specify the direction, and then it's a well-defined question. But if I just say, what is the steepness of the hill, that's not so well-defined unless it's an extremely symmetric hill, which it isn't necessarily. So this direction is very important. So, specifically, if we go into Cartesian coordinates, the potential might be a function of x. And if that is true, I can calculate the x component of the electric field as minus dv over dx. If I've defined x to have a particular direction, which I call positive, then when I do this calculation, if I have an algebraically negative thing, then I know that the electric field component is the other way. If I have a positive thing, I know it's going in the positive x direction. So it's a one-dimensional problem. But life's not so simple. We live in three dimensions. How do you know we live in three dimensions, by the way? What does that mean? Four dimensions, really. What do I mean by that?
It's four information to specify.
Yeah, it takes four bits of information to really specify something. You go into the grocery store and you say, where are the corn nuts?
They have to tell you which aisle, how far down the aisle, and which at which shelf. The fourth comes in because the corn nuts were there yesterday, but somebody came and got them all last night, so they're not there. Okay? So it takes those pieces of information
to specify the position of a point. And that's what you mean when you say you're working in 4 dimensions. Mathematically and in physics, I mean, we do want it to correspond to reality, but mathematically, you can require that there be many, many different things. So when you start doing quantum mechanics, you'll find that you may have systems where you not only have to specify the three space and time, but the momentum and other things are very important. And so you may work in a many, many dimensional space. In that sense, in fact, even potentially an infinite dimensional space. So the whole idea of dimensionality becomes a little bit looser as you start doing stuff in physics. But at this point, it's pretty well defined. So we live in three dimensions. So in principle, you can have the energy of the system at point P. It could vary depending on where it is in three dimensions. So we know how to handle that. We've done it in mechanics many times because we always have, you know, a ball can be moving in three dimensions. How do I handle three-dimensional motion? I break it down into three one-dimensional problems. I calculate each of those separately, right? You might have constant acceleration here and zero this way, etc. And you do the force sum and you calculate what you need. Then you add it all back together vectorially to get the full three-dimensional answer, right? That sounds painfully familiar to you, I hope. So you do the same thing here. You can consider that the electric field vector at a point P is equal to the x magnitude of the electric field along the I direction, well, E to x, so it may also have direction, so it's not just a magnitude, plus the y component of the electric field in the j hat direction, plus the z component in the k hat direction. I wasn't in your mechanics classes, but you guys dig I, k's, and j's. Okay, I could be saying that this is x hat, y hat, k hat, but I'm going to use, and I will. Okay, for maximal confusion, I will probably arbitrarily change, even within the same problem, I hats to x hats. Okay, and you, in fact, you should get in the habit of, perhaps not in your exams, but you don't want to confuse the grader if they're not good at this. But outside of that, you should randomly change this so that anyone who's inspecting what you're doing is absolutely convinced they have no idea what you're doing. Because we need to keep these little secrets tight. Right? It's all about job security. So the economy is going to be tough, so I want to do my part for you guys. All right? I will apologize in advance because I'm not actually kidding that I probably will switch back and forth even within the same problem.
because I really don't think about it. It just sort of comes out. At any rate, or it's in notes, and I mix up notes from 2 years, and it's all a mess. At any rate, so this, I hope, is well-defined for you. And what you'll notice is that I can use this information, and I can do this derivative 3 times, once along x, once along y, and once along z, and get each of these 3 components and add them together, and I have the full 3-dimensional electric field. Okay? So, I can rewrite it this way. Like so. You okay with that? What's the problem with this?
It's messy.
What?
It's messy.
It is messy. And we will fix that. We will take this mess and we will turn it into one symbol, which again has the added advantage of nobody knows what the hell we're doing. But there's actually something wrong with this that is beyond just being messy. What do you think?
These are absolute derivatives, and they need to be partial derivatives.
Yeah, there's a little issue here. This is now multivariable. This is a function of all 3 dimensions, all 3 variables, which means this is no longer a well-defined integral. I mean, derivative, whatever. Okay? Because this has a very specific meaning. It is, what is the slope of the potential in that direction? But if I now can change in the z and the y, that may differ. So it is not well defined to just have a specific, what is it you call it? Definite integral? Is that what is this called?
Partial differential?
No, I'm about to do that. This isn't right at the moment. I have that written as an absolute one-dimensional derivative. Okay. So we have to define a derivative that works in multi dimensions. Okay? And that is a partial derivative, which most of you have probably seen before. Some of you may not have. So we are going to define in a multi-dimensional problem derivative is exactly like the regular derivative, except all those other annoying variables you just treat as if they were constants. So mechanically, it's easy to calculate. So if I have 2xy squared, the partial derivative of this quantity in the x direction is 2y squared. The partial derivative of f in the y with respect to y is going to be 4xy. Okay, so it's simple to calculate. What it really means is if I'm at a certain point in the 3 space, I ask what is the slope at that point? Treating that particular x and y, z and y. Okay, I can ask what is the slope in the x direction if I've specified what z and y are. Okay, so it's like a local slope is a way to think about it. It has the added advantage of this symbol is just way cooler. It is. Because now, I mean, honestly, especially if you guys and who you're running around with around here, I mean, even the students taking physics 113 have seen regular derivatives. Okay, it's just not that special to them. But you start pulling this stuff out. Yeah. Yeah. So I love partial derivatives. So they're totally cool. But if you happen to be in a room where they're not too impressed with those,
then here's what you want to do. We're going to take it from being something that you can almost understand if you look at it to something that you got no prayer. All right? So we're going to rewrite this. The electric field is equal to I hat times minus the partial of V in the x direction plus J hat times the partial of V in the y direction plus K hat times the partial of V in the z direction. And there's a negative sign there.
Okay. So that looks cool, right?
But again, that looks pretty similar to this other stuff. All right, so we need to disguise that as well as we can. So what we're going to do is we're going to say that E is defined as minus the gradient of V. And the gradient is what we call a vector operator. And the gradient is literally defined as
and that would be the gradient in Cartesian coordinates. You can take gradients in other coordinate systems, but just like you have to deal with when you're looking at how the differentials change as you move around, you'll have annoying scale factors and everything that come in, so the gradient will look quite different. But you're not now taking derivatives in the x, y, or z direction. You're taking derivatives in the r, theta, or phi direction, and as you've already discovered, that can be very complicated. So this is the vector operator, and it multiplies this three-dimensional function v, which basically pulls that potential function in these three positions, and you take the derivative of it, but it contains within it these directions. Okay? So v is minus the gradient of v. Okay, you with me? All right, let's figure out just how with me you are.
Imagine that I have two conducting spheres. One is a smaller sphere with radius r1. One is a larger sphere with radius r2. And I take these two spheres and I connect them by a conducting wire. These are conducting spheres. Okay? And let us say that I now have some charge, big Q, that I just deposit on this sphere. The question I have for you is, if we now wait a minute, probably a lot less than a minute, but now we wait for a moment, how does this charge get distributed on the two spheres? And you have four choices. You could say that the ratio of Q1, so Q1 plus Q2 is equal to this big Q. Q1 represents the charge that goes on sphere 1. Q2 represents the charge on sphere 2, and we're going to say that no charge ends up resident on that cable, which is probably not quite true, but we're not going to worry about that. Okay? So, is the ratio of the charge 1 to 2 go as
R2 squared over R1 squared? Does it go as R1 squared over R2 squared, or does it go as R2 to R1, or R1 to R2? You have four choices. I would like you to take a minute by yourself and ponder this and decide in your own mind what you think is the best answer. It is okay to write on a piece of paper if you so choose. Okay, you got your opinions. What I would now like you to do is to look at the answers and decide whether it's A, B, C, or D that you think is the correct answer. Fix that in your mind. Close your eyes. And I'm going to go through each choice, and when it's your choice, I want you to raise your hand, and I'm going to keep track of what fraction of the class think is certain things. Okay? Close your eyes. So you're not biased by other people. Alright. All of those who think the answer is A, raise your hand. B. C. D. Okay, open your eyes. I may have missed a few, and these are clearly not summing up to one, so my estimate's not quite right. One person, I think, said that. One person said this. About a third of the class, so it was about a third or in a third. I got the feeling some of you have commitment issues. We'll let you deal with that as you get older. Okay. So there were fewer who said D than said B. All right. And there were a couple of anomalies up here. So let's think our way through this. Why might you ever say that? What would be your thinking? What do you think?
Because of proportional and circumscribing sphere.
Okay. Makes complete sense. Okay? And most of you, the majority of you, wasn't really the majority of you, a lot of you thought that, okay? If that was the one that most people voted for. And it does sort of make sense. You might think the charge is going to distribute evenly across the area, in which case you have an area of 4 pi r2 squared here, 4 pi r1 squared there. So you'll have less on one, but it will go as the square of the radius. Okay? So it makes sense. Why would you ever choose that one? What do you think?
Because spheres have to be the same potential. I mean, the potential goes as Q over R, not through R squared.
All right. What you know is that these are conductors. If they're conductors, it means it takes no energy. The field is zero on a conductor. So it takes no energy to move a piece of charge from 2 to 1. So by definition, they are at the same potential. And so then what are the implications of that? If they are at the same potential, then
I know that K Q on charge 1 over R1 is equal to K Q on 2 over R2. Because it's a conducting sphere, so I know the charge is on the outside, so it's all at radius R. So there you go. That Q1 over Q2 is equal to R1 over R2. Even though it doesn't really intuitively make sense. So potential has subtleties involved. Okay. So let's do a different one. So this is a hell of a big day. You guys had your first vector operator. And now, this is a big knot. It's your first circuit diagram. I'm proud. Anybody want to pull out their phone for a proud moment selfie? We can do that. I should have brought in a photographer. All right, so first circuit diagram. So there are a few things we have to get straight. Solid line means conductor. All right, so in these things, conductor has no resistance. It takes no work to move from one point to the other. All at the same potential. So I have a conductor that goes from here over to here to these two balls, one of which is bigger than the other. And here I have the same thing on the other side. The fact that these look like they're different sizes, ignore. The fact that these distances look different, ignore. These are supposed to be the same distance apart, and these are supposed to be the same size, and those are supposed to be the same size in this drawing. What in the world is that? So this is a voltage source. The long line here tells you have put positive charge on that thing. So voltage source, think battery. Think something that takes charge, does work, and separates the charge. And when it does so, the positive charge ends up here. Okay? Alright, so this thing puts charge on these various balls, okay? And the charge will distribute as charge will distribute. Let us say that we have this now, this device, sitting out in air. And we keep putting charge, and we keep putting charge, and we keep putting charge. And one of the things that will happen is that if I put a whole bunch of positive charge here and negative charge there, I will get a very large electric field between the various balls. If I have a very large electric field in air is actually made up of molecules that are made up of charged particles. So if I have an atom and I put a huge electric field on it, it's going to rip electrons one way and nucleus the other way, and you'll get a separation of charge. If that happens in air, you call it ionization, okay? So you start pulling the electrons off of the molecules. The electrons begin to flow one way, the nuclei the other way, and basically they will flow. They'll form a conducting current between these two or those two balls. When it happens, you have a lot of violence, so you have a lot of atomic side excitations, and so you get strange things that can happen, like electrons can cascade back down and emit light, so you basically get a spark. And that energy now goes into different forms, so you can hear it, you can see it, you can actually do some chemical reorganization and get ozone, which you can smell. That's the funny smell that you get when you do a spark. Okay, so there's our system. I'm not really displaying this out of thin air because it exists right here. This is called a Wentzverse machine. It's basically just a think of it as a funky looking battery.
Here are the conductors that come, and here are the big balls and the little balls. And we have this to try to make sure that they are the same distance apart. So the big balls and the little balls are the same distance apart. So I'm now going to charge this thing up until we get a spark. And what I would like to know is the spark going to first jump between the big balls, the little balls, or both simultaneously? Those are your three choices. So take a minute and think through that. Close your eyes. All of those who think it will be between the large spheres, between the small spheres, both simultaneously. Okay, between the large spheres there were about 3 hands. For the small spheres there were probably about 5 hands. And then most of the rest of you said between both spheres. And I'm pretty sure we still have a few of you with commitment issues. Okay, so let's think about this one. What would determine where a spark happens? Sorry, what? The biggest potential difference between two balls. Well, if you think about that, then you will have the potential difference between the two big balls and the potential difference between the little balls has to be the same. Because the big and the little are all the same potential. So if you think that it's the biggest potential difference that will cause a spark to happen, then I would guess you would raise your hand on C. Is it indeed the potential difference that causes a spark to happen? What do you think? Yeah, what is it that actually starts the spark is the ripping apart of a molecule. That happens if you have the largest force separating the charges. That is the largest electric field. Okay? So while it is true that the big balls and the little balls have the same potential difference, what about the electric field? So let's think about the electric field between the big balls, the electric field between the little balls. I'll do that. I don't know how to do that. So the electric field that you would have at the surface of the big ball is going to be K times the charge that's on the big ball divided by the radius of the big ball squared. Right? Because it's the same as if I had all that charge at a point and I'm at that radius, KQ over R squared. And then for the other ball, you have KQB over RB squared. So now the issue is, how does the charge get distributed between the big B and the little b on each side? And we've just done that. It goes as the radii. So one way to think about this is KQ big B over R sub B times 1 over R sub B. And this is KQ little b over R little b times 1 over R little b, if you wish. This is the potential. They're at the same potential. So the field goes as this quantity that's the same for each times this 1 over R. And if 1 over little r will give you a bigger field. So that means outside of the little ball, even though the potential is the same as the big ball, the way the charge gets done, the actual electric field at the surface of the little ball is bigger by this ratio of the R's. Okay? So let us just do it. Thank you.